All right. Philippians, the book of Philippians. How many of you know very much? What do you know about the book of Philippians? Anyone? Up front. What do you know? Written to the church at Philippi. Yes, someone's. I heard a comment, but I couldn't make it out. Okay, it's one of the prison epistles, correct? Most people believe. I don't know if you remember. It's been a few weeks back when we were in our previous study. We were around Acts, the latter part of Acts, and we talked about how, you know, Paul was arrested in Jerusalem. And then when he made his appeal that he was a Roman citizen, I don't know if you remember that at the end of the book of Acts, but he made his appeal to, I actually have some information about that right here. Made his appeal to Caesar and ultimately was on a voyage heading to Rome to appeal to Caesar. And as a result, you might remember all of the calamity they had on that, ended up losing the ship. They were shipwrecked. Paul ultimately does make it to Rome. He is in prison for about 2 years. Okay, I have an interesting article by Wayne Jackson. I don't know how many of you have heard of Wayne Jackson from Stockton, California. Speaks a lot at Freed Hardeman. Has preached for years. I don't have any idea how old he is. I know that his son has taken up a lot of his work. But he has a great little website called Christian Courier. If I'm not mistaken, I think that is a link on our website. So if you got on West Park website and you look at the links, Christian Courier would be one of those. And Wayne Jackson he writes about everything. So if you've got a question, you're reading through and you got a question, just pop that in. And that's kind of what I did for that two-year period where, you know, the book of Acts just kind of ends, doesn't it? I mean, it just ends abruptly, which is really, really odd to me because Luke is a very good researcher. He's a doctor. You know, when he's writing the Gospel of Luke about Jesus and all that Jesus did, he's very careful in his research. But and I'm not saying that he's not doing that in Acts. He does that beautifully all throughout Acts. And Luke is on a lot of the trips. I mean, those we passages throughout the book of Acts where we did this, we set sail, he was on that final trip heading to Rome. So those we passages are really important. But it just kind of ends, okay? One of the things I thought was really interesting is that God is really not concerned with your curiosity and mine. You know that? I mean, because I want to know what happens. I mean, I want the story to continue. I want to get more details. I want more of a report. I want Luke to do some more research, or I want the Holy Spirit to reveal a little bit more about, you know, the end of Paul's life. Paul was in prison a couple of times. As a matter of fact, in Philippi, he was in jail for just a couple of days. You might remember if you read Acts 16, but we don't get a lot of information, and so what you kind of have to do is you kind of have to put some things together. And I don't know if some of the things that you've put together, but in reading through, and hopefully you did that a couple of times or you listened to it audibly, but you know, he mentions a lot of ladies in Philippi. And I would assume, and I think Brother Wayne Jackson also comes to that conclusion, it's a predominantly female congregation. There's a lot of women in the congregation at Philippi. There are people like Aristarchus and others who are very involved in Paul's ministry to help Paul. And then he gets sick himself. And he knows that the Philippian church is very concerned about him. And so he sends him back. And there's just some things about this church that's really special concerning Paul. And we'll talk a little bit, once we get into the text more, some of those things will come out a little bit more. But you can kind of piece through some things that about Paul's life in those two years in prison. Most assume that he was released and ultimately imprisoned again. And in that second imprisonment, he ultimately dies. Most believe, tradition is held, that he was beheaded, which would be consistent with the way the Romans would have put people to death at that time. And so, you know, when he writes to Timothy, for example, in 2 Timothy, you know, I fought the good fight, I finished the course. You know, he kind of is coming to a conclusion in his life. And so that's around that time. So Philippi is obviously the city where the church is meeting. What else do you know about Philippi or the Philippians? I don't want to try. I have a tendency, because I've got so much going on in my mind right now, to just overdo it, and I don't want to do that. Okay, Lydia, so if you're looking at Acts chapter 16, where does he find people once he gets to Philippi? They set sail and they end up on this second journey, Acts 16. This is what Sister Millie just mentioned, probably about verse 14. Verse 11. Verse 12 is actually where it says, "And from there to Philippi, which is the leading city of the district of Macedonia, a Roman colony. We remained in the city some days." Most people hold to the idea that this was kind of a, for lack of better terms, kind of like a retirement place for Roman soldiers, generals. It's kind of a retirement area. And so, very distinguished area. I don't think that we really find, and I think probably the situation with Lydia here, if we just keep reading, it says in verse 13, "And on the Sabbath day we went outside the gate to the riverside where we supposed there was a place of prayer, and we sat down and spoke to the women who had come together there." There's some things we can pick up from that, and I don't know if you just noticed that or not. So they're on the Sabbath day, right? What is the Sabbath day? What, seventh day? Is that what you said, seventh? What, I didn't hear what you said. I'm just, what did you say? Did you make a comment?
I did.
Oh, you said seventh. I was looking at Keith. I'm sorry. But Miss Janice said seventh. That's right. So that was, but what day was that? It was a holy day. It was the day of worship for the Jews. Right. What's interesting here? Well, they're having prayer. What's interesting right here? Where would they normally be on the Sabbath, more than likely? A synagogue. But I think the idea is there's no synagogue in Philippi. It was a colony that was run by Rome in Macedonia. I'm not real good. Maybe I should have put a map up there. Is that Greece? Someone help me out. I'd have to look back at my maps here. Yes, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Shane says yes, so we're just going to go with that. So without looking it up, we're just going to take you right here on your word. So Macedonia being in that area, I would just assume being a Roman territory, not many, it would be more Gentile than it would be Jewish. But there are some people who are Jewish in that area, right? Because these people are, we would understand, Jewish on the day of, on the Sabbath day. It says, "We went outside the gate to the river where we supposed there was a place of prayer and sat down and spoke to the women who had come there." Again, one of the things that Paul did on all of his journeys was he immediately went to places where Jewish people were worshiping. Now, if there's a synagogue there, that's the first place he goes. I would assume in Philippi, again, not having necessarily a synagogue, but having a spiritual place where people met, that's where Paul finds himself in this setting. One who heard us was a woman named Lydia. What do you know about Lydia? Where was she from? Thyatira. What was her occupation? Seller of purple, more than likely, I would say she was doing well for herself. a seller of purple goods who was a worshiper of God, the Lord opened her heart to pay attention to what was said by Paul. And after she was baptized, and that's one of the other things that you see in every one of these journeys, is when they go into a place specifically talking to a people who have an understanding about God, who have an understanding about God's law, wanting to get them, the religious folks of the day, they don't have to go through that idea of saying there's one God, because these people believe that, right? All of these Jewish people who are meeting in these pockets, whether it's in synagogues or here in a certain place in Philippi, he teaches them about Jesus Christ. And then ultimately, when you talk about Jesus Christ, the next step is baptism. I mean, you're going to place your belief, your faith, your confidence, your trust. You know, you're going to turn your life around. You're going to live for Him. But baptism's that kind of that culmination of learning about Jesus Christ. And when you decide to be immersed in the waters of baptism, you're saying, I'm going to do away with the body of sin, and I'm going to place my faith in Jesus and His blood, and you're going to be plunged in that blood so that you can be raised to walk in newness of life. That's the beginning of the church right here in Philippi. So I don't know if you picked up on that. So Lydia is the very first convert here in Philippi. And after she was baptized, and her household as well, she urged us, saying, if you have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come to my house and stay. And she prevailed upon us. So you've got the first conversion. You also have another conversion in Acts 16 in Philippi. Who's the other one? Yeah, the Philippian jailer. So you've got a very unique scenario in that particular story. If I start reading that, I'm going to be completely sidetracked, and we're just going to talk about that. So I'm not going to do it. And I think you would appreciate that too. But that's just man, there's a lesson in that Philippian jailer story about singing in the pain. And that is just a great, great story. So I love that story, but there's another convert. So the church now has its beginning in Philippi on this second journey. Someone said that with the letter to the Philippians, because Paul, now you have to understand, you know, we're well past Acts 16 when Paul is actually writing back to the church at Philippi, right? So the church has been established. You know, there's been a couple of years have passed. Paul's imprisoned. And that's one of the things Sister Millie mentioned a moment ago. It's a prison epistle. And I've got a little bit to work out in my mind personally about at what point this letter was actually written. And that's just a sideline issue, really, because it honestly does not matter. But with the first imprisonment in that two-year period, you know, at the end of Acts, it's interesting because he kind of has a rented house that he is staying in. There's a lot of liberties afforded to Paul as a result of that imprisonment. And in this letter, in the Philippian letter, when you read through it, you know, one of the things Paul talks about is being in what? Yes. So you kind of get, you bring up a good point, because you kind of get more of this idea that he's actually in Rome in prison as he's writing this letter. Okay? When he talks about the whole Praetorian Guard, the whole Palace Guard, you know, that whole scenario. I don't know if you've ever looked up any of that information, but there are about 10,000 soldiers that make up that palace guard. And so Paul's reputation is so massive that when he gets to Rome and he's in jail, I really believe that some people in the Philippian church, well, he mentions it as he writes to the Philippians. I don't know if they were necessarily in the Philippian congregation or if they were if he just mentions it because of the fact that some of the members know some of these people. But he said, you know, some people want to preach Christ for false motives, right? So that they could do me harm. And I really believe that part of Paul's, the legend of the Apostle Paul, really, I really believe that turned a lot of people off. But he not only has a good reputation with the palace guard, but he also has a good reputation, and we kind of get the idea that even some in Caesar's household have been converted to Christianity. So it's just a really interesting letter. And so I've got a little bit to work out in my mind about the timing or which time Paul was in prison as far as when this letter was written, because that 2 year imprisonment where he's kind of under house arrest, so to speak, I don't really get that impression when I read this letter. That's just me personally, okay? I'm just trying to stick with the internal details of the letter. It doesn't seem like house arrest. When there's some of those details are mentioned, it seems more like this is a serious arrest, and this kind of arrest doesn't have a lot of liberties to it. Okay, does that make sense? But you get to see a lot of the Apostle Paul's heart in this letter to the Philippians. More so than any other letter you're going to read. This is my favorite letter out of the New Testament, outside the Gospels, from Acts through Revelation. This is my favorite. Okay? What else do you know about Philippi? Anyone? What? Yes, okay. I would say that is, there are a lot of beautiful things about some of these places where Paul goes and does mission work. And a lot of them have a strategic idea behind them. But being a chief city of Macedonia and having the opportunity of being a chief place for trade, what does that do for the gospel message? You know, gets it, what? It gets it coming and going. You know, I mean, and so that's a beautiful thing about this particular city. And there are a lot of places that Paul goes, and I think for travel's sake as well. I mean, some of these he has to sail to, so it just naturally makes sense, right? What else do you know about Philippi or the Philippian letter or what you want to say very quickly? Anything else? You know, the Bible is interesting. You can take a letter and kind of, or you can take the Bible in general and make it say what you want. You realize that? You can do that. People can do that. How many of you have heard of the King James Version Bible baseball game? Anyone ever heard of that? Well, I found it and I had it saved. I had to actually get an old computer out, old laptop out, and it was as slow as Christmas trying to get something pulled off of that thing. But I finally found it. The King James Version Bible baseball game. And basically all this is, I'm not going to read it all, but just to kind of give you a little bit of a taste of what this is. It's somebody was very creative in going through the Bible and saying, you know, the Bible talks about baseball. And it just kind of took little portions of verses and kind of wove them together to make it sound like a really cool baseball game, okay? But I got a point to this, so just hang in there with me for a moment. It says, the people gathered to see the battle, and there's verses at the end of all these little statements, and sat down to eat and drink old corn and sweet water. Isn't that what you eat? You drink a soda and popcorn, you know. Eli sat up on a seat by a post, and he stretched himself that he may see good. So the people shouted, "Where are the nine?" Get it, nine baseball. I loved this, and y'all are not loving it, okay? That was the deal here. You know, you're a tough crowd tonight. Anyway, said, "Let the young men now arise and play before us." And the first came out and went into the field and stood every man in his place. And Peter called, "Whether it is good or bad, as one mocketh another, do ye so mock him." I'm not really good with all this King James language. But it just goes down and it just talks about different things. They were up to bat and it's a really creative way of someone saying, you know, the Bible talks about baseball. Well, in reality, does the Bible really talk about baseball? You know, are they going like in the big inning, you know? So you get all of that in here, right? So you kind of get the idea. I would say that a lot of the way that people, when they study or view things, whether it's doctrine or whether it's a letter itself, a lot of times what happens is it's kind of a pulling here and a pulling there and a kind of weaving in this and a weaving in that and it making it all seem like it's meant to be with whatever idea we're trying to make it be. Okay? when we study this book, I would just ask that you not do that. Like, don't think about, because I will say the Bible does not contradict itself, right? How many of us agree with that, okay? We believe that. The Bible does not contradict itself. But we can at times do an injustice, and we're going to look at some passages along the way in this letter. We can do letters like this an injustice when we don't read them for the purpose that the author had in mind. You know, when we just take something out and kind of pull it out for our benefit. For example, let me give you a case in point of what I'm saying. And the reason I'm bringing this point up is because as we read this letter, I believe there's a totally different perspective that the Apostle Paul has in mind. And whether you agree with that or not, it's completely up to you. It's not a major doctrinal idea. But I believe there's a purpose he has in mind for writing this. Now, how many of you have heard, this is the letter of joy? These people were just happy Christians. How many of you have heard that? Let me get over to my next slide. How many of you have heard that? Okay. Well, it may be. I got to turn this thing on first, don't I, Keith? There we go. Thank you. It may be. It really may be. That you may be correct, and what others have said may be right. I don't think that these Philippian brethren know it if they're happy. And as we look through this letter and get to the end, I think we'll see it. But we'll take our time getting there. So I just ask that you, as you read this, read it with the intent of just the letter itself. Don't try to pick something out and make it fit over here in some specific way that it was never really meant to be. Does that make sense? Are you following? I mean, I can weave it and make it seem like this is the most joyous group that ever lived on the face of the earth. Personally, as I read the letter, I don't see that. Okay? And we'll get to that point. Let me give you a case in point of how we at times do what I'm talking about. In 2 John, just to give you kind of a very quick synopsis, 2 John, well, not of the letter, but just of the idea. If a preacher is, or Bible class teacher is making a point, and he's making that point, and he's telling everyone, you cannot go against this specific point. A lot of times, this verse, 2 John verse 9, verse 6, and following will be quoted. Okay? And so here's the way something like that would go. Well, let's just go down to verse 9. Just look at verse 9. Anyone who goes too far and does not abide in the teaching of Christ does not have God. The one who abides in the teaching of Christ has both the Father and the Son. So the way that I've generally heard as I'm trying to share tonight is if a Bible class teacher or preacher's giving some kind of point and they say you can't, like baptism, if we were talking about baptism. Baptism's a major biblical doctrine. You cannot change it. You have to be immersed for the remission of sins. We all agree with that. But a lot of times a verse like this will be thrown in there. And basically the way it goes is this. If you don't abide in this specific teaching of baptism, and they'll quote this verse from 2 John, then you are wrong. Well, let me just back up and say, first of all, we stick with the doctrine of baptism because in all those passages where baptism is mentioned, that's what it says, right? We all agree. But we don't have to quote a verse that and take it out of context to make that point, right? See, if I take 2 John verse 9 and say, if you abide not in the teaching of Christ, you don't have God or the Father, that would be a true statement just by itself. But contextually, what is the teaching of Christ in 2 John? Anyone know? Well, not in 2 John. What was it? Okay. Yeah. Okay, well, let me say first of all, should we obey the commandments of Jesus Christ? Absolutely. Jesus said, if you love me, keep my commandments. Let me just back up and get you to follow this real quick. Look at 2 John again. John answers himself here. Okay? And this is love, that we walk according to his commandments. This is the commandment, just as you have heard from the beginning, that you should walk in it. So he's going to give it to you. This is it. This is the commandment. Verse 7, for many deceivers have gone out into the world that do not what? What does it say right here? As what? So the specific doctrine or teach, it's not what John's not telling us about something that Jesus taught. He's teaching us something about who Jesus is. Does that make sense? Okay. So if I used it the way that I said that I've heard it, a lot of times it's in reference to the commandment idea. You know, this is what Jesus taught. And John is making a point that it's not about what Jesus taught, although we have to obey what Jesus taught. We're not trying to contradict that. I'm just saying here, follow along. Many deceivers have gone out in the world who do not acknowledge Jesus is coming in the flesh. This is a what? Deceiver and... what is anti-Christ? Someone who's against Christ. And we're not looking for some big anti-Christ person. I get so enamored with all this stuff that it's interesting in a sense because, that president, he may be the anti-Christ. Oh, no, that person in Russia, what's his name, Putin? Oh, he may be the anti-Christ, right? Antichrist is just what? Say it again, Jim. Anti is against, opposing Christ. So John says there are people who oppose Christ as coming. Was Jesus a real man, yes or no? There are some people who don't believe that. So follow along what he says. This is the deceiver and the antichrist. Watch yourselves that you do not lose heart for what we have accomplished, but that you may receive full reward. Anyone who goes too far and does not abide in the teaching of Christ. What is the teaching of Christ? In this letter. That he what? Came in the flesh. That's this letter. That's the context here. Okay, so he says, watch yourselves that you do not lose heart for what we've accomplished, but that you may receive full reward. Anyone who goes too far and does not abide in the teaching of Christ does not have God. Now, he's not talking about if you don't follow what Jesus said. I would agree. If you don't follow what Jesus said, you don't have God either. Okay, but here specifically, and I think that while Gnosticism may not have been full-blown at the time that John is writing this, he is certainly writing with an anticipation that people are going to question whether Jesus was really a man, that he came in the flesh. And so John's writing this letter to say that if you don't believe that he came in the flesh, you don't have God. The one who abides in the teaching that he is the Son of God who came in the flesh does not have God. The one who abides in the teaching has both the Father and the Son. If anyone comes to you and does not bring, underline it, this teaching, do not what? That's pretty heavy, isn't it? If someone does not believe that Jesus came in the flesh, don't receive him into your house. Do not give him a greeting. For the one who gives him a greeting participates in his evil deeds. I mean, that's a pretty heavy letter. But the point I want to make is, we can make Philippians sound how we want to. People do it all the time. I've heard preachers in the church do it in the sense that we just. You know, have you ever heard those guys who I would call them machine gun scripture quoting preachers? It's kind of like, man, they're just sitting there and they're just firing out those scriptures and, you know, they're just left and right. And if you go back and you look them up, it's kind of like this. It's kind of like this this baseball game. It sounds great. Contextually speaking, it may not be accurate. So, not that I'm criticizing machine gun preachers. Please don't misunderstand me. But I think God gave us His Bible for a reason. With the perspective of looking at Philippians. You know, now there's some things that we can do. We can look when the church started in Acts 16. You know, there's some things that we can gather, like from the end of Acts when Paul was in that 2-year period in prison. You know, was this when he wrote this prison? It is a prison epistle. Was it during that time, or is there some other information that we can pull and kind of answer some of these questions? But as far as the letter to the church at Philippi itself, keep it within the framework that Paul wrote it. Does that make sense? Kind of. I hope you're following a little bit of what I'm sharing. Once again, I think the internal evidence in the book itself, I'm not saying that some of them are not happy. I'm not saying that some of them aren't doing, because he brags on them, doesn't he? I thank God every time I remember you. And then he thanks them, not that I'm in need right now, but I appreciate what you've done for me in the past. And I really feel like that when you get to chapter 4, it sort of starts to come out about why he commands them to rejoice. Should you ever have to command people who are faithful in Jesus Christ to rejoice? Yes or no? I wouldn't think so. Let me say this. This book, this letter, if you will, was not written because some of the verses sound great and look great on T-shirts. Now, there's some cool stuff we can put on T-shirts from this book, right? That's not why Paul wrote it. I've got four verses that I would like for us to memorize in the course of this study. Four simple verses, short, succinct verses. The first one's is Philippians 1, right? Philippians 1, verse 21. We'll get this. For me to live is Christ, to die is... That's a cool verse. I'm just going to tell you, that's a cool verse. But Paul didn't write this letter just so you could pull out cool verses. There's a purpose behind that verse, right? Brent, comment. And people do that all the time. Yes. And we do that. I mean, everybody does that.
Especially things you believe strongly or care about a lot. So that's the risk that we do run here. I think you bring it up very well that happens in all parts of Scripture and all parts of our lives as well, not just here.
Yeah. You know, I would say growing up with a denominational background, I can tell you that the idea of once saved, always saved was something that I grew up believing. I know several of you grew up in a persuasion like that. And I can tell you that I could take Bible verses and weave them and make that doctrine seem very real. You would have to ignore certain passages by Paul and other writers to come up with that. But that's to your point of if you come to it with a preconceived idea, and so everything just kind of fits, right? Or you close your ears to everything that might seem to be a contradiction because this is what you believe in. So that's a very good point. And there are things that we do in the church that are similar in the way we reason. Now, once again, my point about what I read from 2 John and the Bible thing about Bible baseball, we are to follow the commandments of Jesus Christ. So understand, I believe that. And I believe Jesus said that. John 15, verse 14, or John 14, verse 15, wherever. I might have that backwards. He says it specifically. So that's good enough for me. I don't have to read a 2 John passage and take it out of context to make it fit that idea. Does that make sense? So I guess I'm saying that to say, don't take a preconceived idea that you may have about this letter and all of their joy. And once again, I'm not saying that some of them don't have joy. And I'm not saying that some of them are not rejoicing at all, because I believe some of them are. I'm just saying, let's work our way through this letter together in the way that I believe Paul wrote it. Now, you may come to a different conclusion than I do. I mean, the fact that I don't think they're very happy does not change whether I'm going to heaven or not, okay? And the fact that you may think this is the happiest congregation, this meaning the Philippian church. We are the happiest congregation in America, right? You know, the fact that you may think that the Philippian church is that way, that's okay. We can disagree. That's okay. But I just want you to read it without any bias, preconception, any ideas. Read it through and try to look at, okay, what is this connected to? Why did he say this? Read before and read after and try to put it together. Here's the way this class will roll for the next 12 weeks. This is the first one. There's 13 weeks and a quarter. The next 12 weeks, we're going to kind of, and once again, I actually have some filler in this, believe it or not, in the way that I did this, because if I want to talk a little bit longer on some things than others, I can just say this is what we're going to do this week. But kind of the way it will go, we did a little bit of an introduction. I've got a little bit more, as long as time will allow, of an introduction to kind of give. We're going to kind of sort out the pieces next week, look at some things that Paul appears to be bringing up in this letter, just as a whole, kind of a little bit of an overview. Chapter 1, we're going to look at chapter 1 in week 3, Living the Dream. Okay, that's chapter 1. We're going to have a memory verse that we're going to remember from chapter 1. So hopefully, and I didn't print up enough of these, but I'll do that for next week and we'll have some. But hopefully by week 3, we will have Philippians 1:21 memorized. Okay, we'll talk about important teachings from chapter 1 because we're not going to go verse by verse. You know, that's where if you go verse by verse, that's where you start digging into all this other stuff. And while it may not contradict anything, I'm not sure that's how Paul intended this letter to be written. I meant read. Okay? So we'll just look at some important teachings from chapter 1. And then on week 5, we'll talk about when teaching transforms my life. Okay? So we're going to do that with every chapter. We're going to look at an important teaching or a doctrinal point from that chapter. And we'll look at when that teaching does something, whether it's week 1 transforming my life, whether it's week 8 in chapter 2 transforming my view of people, whether it's week 3 when we, not week 3, actually week 11 in chapter 3 when we talk about when teaching transforms me spiritually. So I think Paul's making these points in this letter. And then chapter 4, we'll just kind of have to do a quick little summary of chapter 4. Week 13, though, we will kind of put the pieces together and look at it and say, oh, I didn't really see that. I hope that's what you say. I hope you get to that point and say, I didn't really see that. But reading through it and kind of going through it, it makes sense looking at the internal evidence itself. Okay? So we'll take these four chapters, four very... very simple chapters, and we'll talk about them a little bit as we go along. Okay, let me get through a lot of this very quickly because I talked about some of this. All right, missing. Is the church at Philippi, is it a mature church? Yes or no? The perspective of maturity, I guess you have to know kind of what that means, but read through the first three verses very quickly and tell me what you think. I don't think I picked up those other notes. Doesn't matter. I've read this, I think, 5 or 6 times over the course of this last week. Is this a mature congregation, would you say? I would say so. Let me say this. Every congregation, maturity is not based on whether you have struggles or challenges or problems. I mean, do we have struggles and challenges and problems here at West Park, yes or no? Would you agree that West Park's a mature congregation? I would like to think so, you know. But notice the lack of, there's not a congregation with a lack of problems. That does not exist, right? I mean, churches are filled with people, and what do people have? They do. And that's okay, Robert, because we're not perfect. I know Robert, he's not perfect. I tell you one thing you don't want to do with Robert. Can I tell you one thing you don't want to do with Robert? Okay, there may be more than one, let me just say. as I think about this. And Yusef, don't talk. Son-in-law back there, because he could say, well, wait a minute, you didn't touch on this one. You know, but I can tell you that do not call Robert when he has had a steroid shot. Because that thing starts kicking in, and I mean, it's like 5 hours. I finally was like, oh, Robert, I got to go, man. I'm teasing. It's really only 4 hours? Yeah. 5 hours, and 4 hours and some change is what it was, and some change. Don't call Robert when he's had a steroid shot. Those things just kind of jazz you up, don't they? And you're just, you know, you're just like, hold on, I can rewind, let's go back. No, I'm that way anyway, and I don't have steroid shots. All right, notice the first couple of verses. We're not going to get into all of the dynamics of these first three verses, but pick this out. Paul and Timothy, so Timothy's with Paul. Timothy was at Paul's side providing aid. Others were there as well. I think some of the others that are mentioned here are there providing aid and stuff. Paul, in writing this, he says, Paul and Timothy, servants of Jesus Christ. Notice the first designation here. To whom? Saints, right? All the saints in Christ Jesus who are at Philippi. So who are we talking about first? Just talking about the church, right? It's those church members, when you're in Christ Jesus, you are a saint, right? There's an interesting way of looking at this. What does Paul say about himself and Timothy? Servants. What would you rather be called, a servant or a saint? But I don't think that that's the argument Paul's making here, right? I don't think that's it, okay? But he does call himself a servant, calls Timothy a servant. As he's writing, I think it's just a term of endearment. You know, when you write someone a letter, you acknowledge them and the blessing of who they are, and that's kind of what's going on here. So we've got saints with the overseers. Who are those people? What? Are the overseers here? Elders, right. I think the Greek word is episkopos. No, I'm not for sure now. Is that it? Is that what it says? Yes. Epe is over. Skopeo is to look or to watch. So episkopoi is someone who watches over. It's kind of the idea, the way that you see it used in Scripture. It's kind of the way someone would cut forward through a path as they were clearing out a path. And that's an interesting, by the way, that's a really interesting word to talk about elders. But in a sense, isn't that what they're doing? Cutting forward a path for us to follow? That's just a great picture there that's used, episkopoi. To all the saints in Christ Jesus who are at Philippi, so you've got saints, you've got overseers, shepherds, elders, the way that it's used in Ephesians chapter 4, pastors, okay? The elders, Acts 20:28, take heed to yourselves and to all the flock among which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers. Same word in Acts 20:28. To shepherd, feed, literally feed, the church of God, which he purchased with his own blood. What's interesting about the eldership is that all of those different Greek terms that are used about that one office give a different picture, a different concept about those men, their leadership, their involvement, their decision making. It's not just feeding. There are several things in all of those words that are used for that one office that carry a distinct picture idea about their service in God's kingdom. And so I find that God beautifully, in doing that, gives us not a perfect man, a man who is a sinner just like us all, but does meet scriptural qualifications, as Paul writes to Timothy and Titus and tells him about those. But but men who not only are scripturally qualified, but they have a tremendous weight on their shoulders. They have a tremendous responsibility in God's family. And so that's kind of the idea. So you've got overseers here and deacons. What are deacons? That's what Sister Millie was mentioning a moment ago. They're those special servants who are selected from among God's family to serve in some capacity. I find the way that we select deacons just odd, to be honest with you. To me, if they are scripturally qualified, they meet the qualifications Paul writes to Timothy about. But how they are selected, a lot of times we just say, okay, we're going to install some deacons, and we want you guys to select some people, and you select those people, and we put those men before the church. Okay, these guys are going to be added as deacons, and if you got anything against them, then you speak up. Isn't that kind of how we do it? But the only thing is, what if you have a responsibility that you want? First of all, it needs to be service. There has to be some ministry that those guys are selected for. It's not just that we want deacons, right? It has to be a defined ministry. And then once you have a defined ministry, what if we say, okay, we're going to put old Joe up here, and Joe's going to be a deacon. The only thing is, Joe, from a perspective of his ability, doesn't fit the ministry that we have. What good's Joe going to do in serving as a deacon? I mean, you don't want me handling money, I'm just going to tell you. You don't want me handling money. You don't want me building a building. I know nothing about building a building. But the way we would do it is, well, Charles is a pretty good guy. I think Charles could be a good deacon. Let's put his name forward. Anybody got anything against Charles? No, man, he's a great guy. Let's put Charles in as a deacon. I tell you what, one of the areas we'd like to put him over is building. That would make no sense. But that's kind of how we do it. Needs to be a defined ministry. And then that person's ability needs to match that ministry. Okay, I don't want some mean-spirited old geezer that has no compassion serving in benevolence. Right? How's that going to work? You know, someone that's needing some help, tell them to get a job. I mean, that's not going to work very good, right? I mean, just think about it. Think about the way there's a rationale behind service and the dynamic of the person for that service. But what you have beautifully in this particular intro here of this church is you kind of see its beginning in Acts 16. And then you see that since that time, the beginning of that church, they mature to the point where now there are other members added to that local body in Philippi. And now as a congregation, they are thriving because they have, I said, a predominantly female congregation. There are men in this congregation, obviously, because they are overseers and they are deacons. But what you have is you have the beautiful picture of God's plan for the church right here in Philippians 1 in the first couple of verses. And that's every congregation. Every congregation should strive to be. I have worked for congregations that if one person died, the whole leadership would be gone. And I mean, just because everybody was connected either to one person or the other. A mature congregation should desire to have elders, should desire to have deacons, and should desire church growth. And that's what you see with the church at Philippi, is you see a mature congregation that I would say is flourishing. I just believe that Paul is writing a letter to them to remind them about who they are, who they serve, and how what he's writing should take hold in their lives, because it appears they're not very happy. Chapter 2 in this letter is the best chapter in all the Bible. And I'll just leave it there. All right? I'll try to have some more of these printed up next week. If you want to take one, certainly feel free. I think I've got about 10.